Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The United States Supreme Court finished its 2013-14 term yesterday with its most awaited decision of the term, ruling that a closely held corporation, in this case Oklahoma's Hobby Lobby, could not be compelled to provide certain contraceptives under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act due to their statutory rights and objections under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, this is perhaps the most publicized decision of the court's term. It was by far not the only important decision. There are important issues of First Amendment free speech rights, Fourth Amendment search and seizure laws, copyright law, presidential power, federal election law, and affirmative action decided during the court's term. Today on Studio Tulsa, I'm joined by constitutional law specialist Professor Lynn Inseroth to look at the court's decisions this term. Inseroth is an associate dean of the University of Tulsa Law School and a professor of law. Lynn Inseroth, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me. It's a pleasure.
After last year's momentous Supreme Court term, a lot of court watchers this year looked at the cases that were coming up and thought it would be a bit of a snoozer, but in fact, that's been far from the case. How would you characterize this term?
This has had some big blockbuster cases. Now, some of the interesting things this term is we did see some important cases that were unanimous by the court, but we also see some very tight 5-4 decisions with the usual division of the court that you often see with Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Alito, and Thomas. And then on the other side, you tend to have Justice Ginsburg, Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. And then Justice Kennedy in the middle, going back and sort of being our really the middle of the court and really often who a case has to be pitched to.
And I think you saw in some of the decisions, the decisions were crafted to appeal to Kennedy's vote, where I think you when you look at their writings and some of their dissents in previous cases, when these guys are writing the opinion, they're far more moderate in how far they went. And you saw a lot of sort of two-thirds of the way or halfway to where their position was in order to get Kennedy's vote.
I mean, I think that's true. I think it is, this is something that's happened throughout the court's history, that the court, you know, we have 9 justices and you need 5 to win the day. So often how that majority opinion is crafted is to make sure those 5 votes stay intact, which sometimes means a more narrow or moderate decision than perhaps the writer would have written had he not had to worry about keeping his coalition, his or her coalition.
The Hobby Lobby case is a pretty prime example of that, isn't it?
I think that's very true. The Hobby Lobby case was decided yesterday. It was one of the big blockbuster cases that everyone was waiting for. It was a 5-4 decision, and the majority opinion was written by Justice Alito, and he was joined by Justices Scalia, Thomas, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Kennedy. But Justice Kennedy wrote a concurring opinion that potentially narrows the scope of the majority opinion. Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissenting opinion. She was joined with Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor. And Justice Ginsburg, in her opinion, discussed what she really thought were the breathtaking reach of the majority opinion and her concerns about the effect of this case going forward. And Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, tried to moderate that a little bit. So, yes, you saw that dynamic.
Now, for those who are not completely familiar, other than knowing that Hobby Lobby doesn't want to provide certain contraceptives for their employees under the Affordable Care Act, this goes to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was, I think it was enacted in the early 1990s, and it involved a man who was using peyote as a part of the Native American religion, and he was arrested by police. And this was Congress's way of saying, look, you can't arrest a guy for a minister basically administering peyote during a religious rite. And over the years, as far as I can see, when that issue has come up in other cases, the federal judiciary has basically been trying to limit the power of the religious. I mean, Quakers have to pay income tax. The idea is that it's going to limit it. This totally flips that on its head because this is giving those rights not to individuals but to a corporation.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think
even though it's a closely held corporation.
Yeah, I mean, there are some really breathtaking things, according to Justice Ginsburg, and I think many people view this as a really eye-opening case. with respect to the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, which many people refer to as RFRA. Now, let me just sort of back up about Hobby Lobby a little bit just to make it clear what was happening. Under the Affordable Care Act, employers have to provide 20 or 21 different forms of contraceptives for women to be able to use, and Hobby Lobby objected to four of the contraceptives that would have been available to their for female employees, and they challenged this as being a violation of their rights under the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, not the Constitution. This was not a constitutional First Amendment issue. This was a federal statute, the RFRA statute. Now, one of the things that Justice Alito did in this opinion was to say that corporations, privately held, closely held corporations, are persons for the purposes of the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, so that the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act applies to corporations like Hobby Lobby.
Now, if I am a member, I own a small business, and my religion believes in the strict segregation of sexes. If I'm to read this statute right, can I say men to the left, men to the right, and put a wall in between them when they come to my restaurant or my small business?
We don't know the answer to that. And that's what this court has sort of, this is one of the criticisms that's sort of emerging now from the, or questions about the Hobby Lobby decisions, and certainly a criticism that Justice Ginsburg had about the majority opinion. Now, what the majority opinion said was, we're just talking about this case. We're just talking about contraception, which is contraceptives that are required under the Affordable Care Act. And at least with respect to race discrimination, we're not talking about race discrimination. And Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, said, really, we're just talking about this provision of the Affordable Care Act. But what Justice Ginsburg has said, and a number of legal commentators have also raised this question since yesterday, was, where is the limit on this? So could a, as you suggested, could a private, closely held corporation say, I am going to segregate the genders in my workplace, or I don't believe that women should hold senior positions in my business, so even a qualified woman will not be entitled, I will not promote her in violation of federal law, or I don't believe in vaccines. That is a sincerely held religious belief of mine, so I'm not going to provide vaccines for my employees under the.
That's interesting. Care. Justice Kennedy's opinion actually referred to vaccines. This is, this doesn't apply to vaccinations or blood transfusions, but how can you say that? I mean, this is the issue that's going right. to, I think, come out of this case is that in saying that a closely held corporation has the same rights as a person, which this goes back to something going back to Citizens United, where companies have the same rights as individuals there. That this is going to open a lot of doors for litigation.
I think so, too. And that's one of the takeaways that many people are having from Hobby Lobby. And certainly it's one of the concerns that Justice Ginsburg raised in her case. And one of the things to think about with respect to this is sexual orientation and the impact that this case will have on businesses who do not want to do business with individuals because of their sexual orientation. We know in the news in the last year or so,
there's been a baker and a wedding photographer that have been compelled to do business or held accountable for not.
Yes, and there will be a state statute or a local regulations that say you cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation. But the business owner says, well, that violates my sincerely held religious beliefs. Justice Ginsburg said, it is not clear from this decision what the effect would be. In fact, she said, not only it looks like this decision would allow that to happen, which then we run into the question, what effect will this have on anti-discrimination laws with respect to gender, sexual orientation, family relations, all sorts of things. So I do think that there will be future litigation on this issue, and we will see how courts narrow it. Now, Justice Alito said this certainly wouldn't apply to race discrimination acts by a private employer, which in the 1960s, those businesses that did not want to serve African Americans claimed religious protection. Justice Alito said that's not true, but they only mentioned race. Now, Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, said no, it's just this really, this contraceptive issues. How they will narrow that and stick with that in the future is, I guess, future litigation and future cases before the Supreme Court.
Well, that wasn't the only decision that came down. Public sector unions were very worried as they went into the last day because Harris v. Quinn was going to be decided. And this was a case that prevents the deduction of fees from non-union home health workers who are represented by a public sector union under collective bargaining. And what the court did was it certainly hurt the public sector unions in saying you don't have to deduct the dues, but it also allowed some leeways for the unions to continue to represent those folks, and that if they can separate where the money goes, they could possibly charge a fee if it's directly for the collective bargaining costs.
Yeah, this is an interesting case, and it gets back to what you were mentioning earlier, Rich, about how sometimes the decisions don't go as far as we think they're going to go, right? So one of the commentators who were looking at the Harris v. Quinn decision before the court handed it down thought that this gave the court an opportunity to overturn a case from the 1970s that requires public employees to join or pay union dues to their union for whom they receive the benefits of collective bargaining.
Even though they're not a member.
Right. Even though they're not a member, they get the benefits of collective bargaining. And the court could have reached that far, but did not. And these workers here were partial public employees. They were home health care providers. And the court said, for these individuals, we see that the First Amendment is violated by requiring them to contribute union dues. Now, I think the question is, will there be the next case that directly challenges that 1977 decision? Justice Alito, who also wrote the Harris v. Quinn case, intimated that that might be something that's ripe for review. The question here is whether or not they would have Justice Scalia on board. He has raised some questions about whether or not he would be willing to go that far. So again, it depends on how if they can get their vote of five and whether or not the court will take that case up again.
Now, there were a couple of free speech cases. McCollum versus Coakley came down in the last few days. This was the Massachusetts buffer law for abortion protesters. And they had a quite wide zone. I think it was like 35 feet. And the court struck that down. Now, earlier, there was another case involving Secret Service moving protesters away from a presidential visit site. And these seem to be diametrically opposed.
Well, they are an interesting contrast. And I think the court can make some distinction between the two of them. But let me first just talk a little bit about the Wood versus Moss case, which involved the Secret Service. This was actually a unanimous decision authored by Justice Ginsburg. And in this decision, there were individuals who had gathered outside to hear a speech from President Bush. And the Secret Service removed some of the protesters, people who opposed President Bush's policies, they moved them further away, but left those speakers
who
supported President Bush, they allowed them to stay where they were. And those protesters who were moved away sued the Secret Service. And the court said, first of all, the Secret Service, when they acted, thought they were acting in compliance with the Constitution, so the lawsuit against those agents can't go forward. But for future cases, the court said, if there are reasonable security reasons for moving the protesters away by Secret Service, that could be okay. However, the Secret Service could not move individuals away just because of the content of their beliefs or just because they may disagree with the president. There has to be some security threat.
Now, isn't that the whole reason for the buffer zones entirely, which is that it was security issues?
Yes, it's such an interesting question that you asked. Now, that case, the McCollum versus Coakley case, is a 5-4 decision. The court was very contentious here. There was a 35-foot buffer zone around the abortion and reproductive services clinics in Massachusetts. And it was a state law that provided for that, and it was to protect the women going into the clinic. And the individuals who challenged that as a violation of their First Amendment right were some protesters on the street who asserted that what they wanted to do was to speak to the women and perhaps counsel the women going into the clinic for their services. The Supreme Court found that 35-foot barrier was unconstitutional because it was not the narrowest way to protect these women from these protesters who wanted to talk to them. So a couple things are going on here. One, we don't necessarily see, we don't have evidence that there is a physical or violent threat from these protesters, though I assume that the women who are probably going to the clinic certainly don't want that confrontation or that interaction. That's certainly the sense that we get. Also, the state of Massachusetts, according to the Supreme Court, really had not shown that this was some pervasive problem and that this was the only way to resolve it. The real problem was on Saturday morning at a clinic in Boston, and there was an indication that the Boston police could have provided sufficient protection for the women going into services of that. So it doesn't mean that there can't be protection for women around the clinic, but it has to be a way that is narrowly tailored, and that's a language that the court uses, narrowly tailored to achieve the goal of protection while not infringing too much on the rights of the protesters. And it's a fine balance. But it is interesting to see there really is sort of a contrast between these two cases.
My guest today is Lynn Inseroth, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa Law School. She teaches constitutional law. And we're doing a roundup of the U.S. Supreme Court term, which finished up yesterday with a bang with the Hobby Lobby case and also a union case. But there were a lot of big cases in the last week or so of the court, and the court kind of does that. They're kind of they have a sense of drama. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. A couple of those cases I'd like to talk about. One which actually extended private protections, Riley versus California, which says that police cannot search a digital phone, a digital device on your person without a warrant. Now, that seems to be, I don't know. I suppose that's an increase of private protection. But basically, they were quite certain in saying, you get a warrant, period.
Yeah, and this is the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which requires warrants before a search. And it is a very interesting question. It was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court that when you are arrested and they seize your phone, before the police search your phone, they want to look at your text messages, they want to look at, I have Facebook on my phone, they want to look at your Facebook page. Before they can do that, they have to get a warrant. This doesn't mean that the police cannot search your phone, but they have to get a warrant before they do that.
And I thought that it was really interesting. This is a technology of our time sort of case because, you know, a lot of things we keep on our phones would have been in our papers, stored in, you know, locked desks in the past or in our files. And a lot of times they're on our person in our phones.
Yeah, and Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, said that it is a pervasive part of our lives. And not only is it a pervasive part of our lives, it holds all that kind of personal information. I know for me, I'm sure for the justices as well, it holds a great deal of personal data that they believe the government has to get a warrant before they can look at it.
Now, another big case, this will limit presidential power in the mm-hmm. future, and it's the NLRB versus Cannon case, which limits the president's ability to make recess appointments. Presidents, over a long amount of time, have offered recess appointments, which puts a person into the post because he cannot get them confirmed in the Senate. And more presidents recently have done that, and probably President Obama took it to a new course by putting recess appointments in a 3-day recess. And the court said that's not a recess appointment.
Yeah, the court was very interesting in the Noel Canning case. In some ways, it made it clear that presidents can do recess appointments. And the Constitution does provide for the president to have recess appointments. And as the court pointed out, the president has been doing this since the beginning of the republic, that this is sort of a relationship and understanding that both Congress and the president have used since the beginning of our history. Right? This is a well-established practice of presidents to make recess appointments. In fact, a couple of our Supreme Court justices, not current, but past Supreme Court justices, were recess appointments, including Chief Justice Earl Warren and Justice William Brennan. And the court said, so the president can make recess appointments, but there are limits. They said the Senate needs to be in recess. 3 days, not long enough. And that's what it was in this case, 3 days. And they said that is not enough for a recess appointment. They also said that pro forma sessions, which was what was going on here, that's okay. The Congress can do that. They can have that pro forma session.
It's giving a big power to the minority. And right now it's the Republicans. It may be the Democrats in future years. But you know, one of the underlying issues of this was basically the minority didn't want the National Labor Relations Board to function. Right. And by holding up the appointments, it can't function because they don't have enough sitting commissioners. So is there any legal recourse there, or is the courts unlikely to get into something like that? Because this is a squabble between the executive and legislature.
This is such an interesting and difficult question. And certainly President Obama used his recess appointment power in part, I think in large part, because of frustration with the Senate and their unwillingness to act on his appointments, which has been a criticism, an issue that his administration has raised a number of times with respect to the Senate. Whether or not the court will ever resolve or even should get into this dispute between the president and the Senate is a very interesting question, and my guess is the court will not wade into that. First, we'd have to have someone bring suit. I mean, it would have to be the president suing or perhaps a nominee suing the Senate, and that seems unlikely. I'm not sure that they would have a legal standing to do that. And even if they did, the court often is unwilling to step into that particular dynamic. And that's usually an issue that gets resolved by the political process. And I think the effect of this will depend on whether or not we have a Republican or Senate majority in the Senate come this fall.
There's a couple of cases that were, it's kind of caught people's attention just because it's kind of a soap opera. I think you told this off the air. It's Bond versus U.S. And this is a case of, I believe it was a Pennsylvania wife. I may be wrong on the state, but a wife who discovered her husband was having an affair with, I think, a best friend or something like that, or a close acquaintance. And she decides to poison her, and she puts toxic chemicals on her doorknob and various places she's going to touch in order to poison her. The state came in and said, well, not only are you trying to harm this person, you violated the chemical weapons treaty. And the court said, no, you can't prosecute a domestic poisoning under the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Yeah, it was a high drama in the soap opera way. I believe that the mistress was also pregnant at the time, and the jilted wife was spreading these chemicals. And the court said that is not the intent of this federal statute. This is not the intent of the treaty to reach these kinds of small, really state law type matters, that this is not outside the scope of this, now that this was looking more at chemical weapons as opposed to a jilted wife.
Now, does this have more serious implications where you see local jurisdictions using anti-terrorism legislation against things that you might have prosecuted under state law before? Does this provide a precedent against doing that?
I think there may be some question about how far treaties can reach to small in-state activities, but I don't know if the court did not.
And this is about the treaty as opposed to a law that the United States passed.
I think one of the things that we do see something happening in this case is that a purely local matter involving a domestic dispute is certainly outside the scope of a treaty. Whether the court will limit the ability of Congress to reach these small local matters under treaties, I think, is an open question. And the court is actually, it's something that it's wrestled with for many years. And this case did not answer that, so it'll probably come back up again before them.
Yeah. A couple other big cases were decided earlier in the term. One was McCutcheon versus the FEC, and this is ends the two-year cap on aggregate campaign donations. And this falls in the wake of Citizens United and a couple of other decisions involving campaign donations. This ends that two-year limit on how much money you can give. Is this setting the stage for just sort of ending the financial limits on campaign contributions? I mean, I think it's Buckley versus Vallejo, which put a lot of these limits in place. Do you think the stage is being set for basically overruling Buckley?
I think that's an interesting question, and I know how frustrating it is to have a law professor say interesting question and then directly answer, but unfortunately, I think that's the nature of this beat.
But this is another little cut into Buckley versus Vallejo.
Absolutely. I mean, what the Supreme Court here did was say that the aggregate limits on campaign contributions violates the First Amendment and has rendered that unconstitutional, that the federal government cannot do that, except if there is quid pro quo corruption, right? That you pay someone directly for a specific act. The idea that there could just be an appearance of impropriety or an appearance of corruption or the value of leveling the playing field are not good enough, according to the Supreme Court.
And that makes it a lot harder to prosecute any sort of public corruption.
And that was exactly the point of the dissenters, which was written by Justice Breyer, who has a real passion for the importance of the democratic process and his concerns about the appearance of impropriety and that corruption is much broader than I'll give you $100,000 if you rule this way on this bill. I believe that the Senate Judiciary Committee has held hearings about a possible constitutional amendment to deal with this type of what case, as well as the Citizens United and the other efforts by the court to really limit the ability of Congress to regulate campaign contributions.
Is there a case in the system that's moving its way up to actually that would actually overrule the individual giving to an individual candidate, which is, I think, the only limit left from Buckley?
I do not know of any specific case out there, but I would believe that, you know, it's very likely that someone who's going to be limited by the remaining limit on campaign contributions will see this as an indication that perhaps they should try to challenge that provision of the statute as well.
Now, the last case we're going to talk about is Schutt versus the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. This was a Michigan case. This actually has Oklahoma connections because Oklahoma, like Michigan, has a voter decision to remove the use of race and sex and factors in public university admission. I think ours is just an overall ban on affirmative action. But that was the Michigan voters' decision that not to use race and sexist factors for admission into public university. The court overturned that, said, voters can do that.
They did. And again, it was a 6-2 decision. Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. He made very clear that they were not ruling on the appropriateness of affirmative action. They were not ruling whether or not affirmative action violated the Constitution. All they were ruling on was whether or not state citizens of a state could, by state constitutional amendment, limit the ability to use affirmative action, in this case in higher education. And they said citizens could do that in a state by referendum. Now, Justice Sotomayor, who wrote the dissenting opinion in this case, her opinion was three times as long as the majority opinion.
It was a barn burner, too.
And she said that this is really going to have a really detrimental effect on opportunities for minority people in the United States.
Yeah. Well, it was a really interesting term, and it looks like next term is going to be very interesting because you have all these same-sex marriage decisions coming through the system, through the Court of Appeals. Are these likely to end up at the Supreme Court next term, you think?
Well, I think this is within next term or the term after. I mean, I think that this is a hot issue for the court. Now, the court sometimes will avoid ruling on decisions because right now it looks like all the federal courts are in agreement in striking down these same-sex marriage prohibitions. But they raise many interesting and provocative questions, and the most recent one out of the Tenth Circuit directly discusses the 14th Amendment and its protection of same-sex marriage. So I think that this is something that the court is going to have to take on. Also, these recent decisions all turn on the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor last term. So I think this is something that the court needs to address. And I think eventually something will get to the court on this.
All right. Well, Lynn Enseroth, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It was a pleasure.
University of Tulsa Professor of Law Lynn Enseroth speaking with us about the recently concluded U.S. Supreme Court term here on Studio Tulsa. Studio Tulsa is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.